And Madam Secretary, just so you know, we are just about to continue delving into House Bill 472. We're going to set that aside briefly and go back to House Bill number 334 by Representative Meyer. Since we now have full committee and present for the record are all of the members I mentioned before, plus Representative Ogg has joined us. Okay. Representative Meyer, did you want to say any final closing comments?
No, Madam Chair, I don't think you want me to go back to what we discussed for Representative Ogg. So I'll just say that I think the differences that Representative Gruenberg and myself had were real close to resolving, and I think it's just going to be a matter of some intent language or a simple amendment just to show that we're not after the young kids who are having consensual sex. That's not our intent, to bump them up to Class A felony. We'd leave that at a Class B felony.
Okay.
And I think that's a relatively easy fix and shouldn't be one that too many people would disagree with. So I would respectfully ask that we go ahead and pass this out and let Representative Gruenberg and myself continue to work on this before it reaches that floor.
Okay.
You want a motion?
From the committee, any comments before? Representative Gruenberg.
Unless anybody else has any comments, I don't want to cut anybody off, but I'll move the bill. That's the H version, and any fiscal notes in it.
A couple of zero fiscal notes.
Zero.
Is there any objection to that motion? Okay, hearing none, House Bill 334 is moved. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Ms. Cunningham and Mr. Meyer. Okay. That brings us back to House Bill number 472. And okay, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I assume there's no one else to testify. I, at the last meeting, however many days ago, like we were here 12 days ago before the Energy Council break, there were two amendments that I was considering, and I'm not saying they're not somewhat worthy of debate and passage, but I think at this time I'm going to hold off in pushing those. One was, which I think there's some merit to, a definition of economic damages, and Representative Garrett and some others gave me some insight on that, and I concur with them to a degree. To another degree, I think we need some definitive aspects placed in statute, and maybe at a later date that could be pursued, whether in this bill or in other through other means. And then the other bill, amendment, was regarding the, and this one I really agree with more, but I'll hold off today so we can move the bill, the redundancy and possibly the confusion on the informed consent, some of the aspects and verbiage in the current bill. But I think at this stage, talking to the associations and those who are interested in sponsorship of the bill, that I support the bill as it is. So I'm not going to offer either amendment, but I just wanted that on the record because we debated it.
That's right. Okay. Representative Gruenberg.
Are we on the A version or did we adopt the C?
Madam Secretary?
Just A version.
Yeah.
So we're still on the A version. And
Okay.
Representative Anderson's right. We were going to adopt those, and now we won't. But Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Representative Holm, I guess, is in another committee making quorum, and I thought I would like to run through just some of the other evidence I've come up with, and I just want to say some things on the record. And
this would be a good time.
I passed out to the committee members some other materials. Most of these materials address issues that came up during the testimony on this bill, and I just want to share this with the committee members. There was some testimony by some of the insurance folks that about whether or not malpractice settlements have gone up on average, gone down on average over the years, and so the medical board keeps a record of all settlements and verdicts, and I've handed that out to members. On average, the settlements and verdicts just radically change from year to year, and it's because these are statistically sort of irrelevant samplings. I mean, one year you might have 3 brain injuries, and one year you might have 4 broken arms, and So to sort of expect that the settlement amounts would remain the same every year would be unrealistic. But I guess of the claims in 2003, the average settlement was about $341,000. In 1991, it was $380,000. It's gone really, really quite significantly up and down from year to year. But I don't think that there's any evidence that really establishes that somehow verdicts are getting much larger in recent years. And so we provided a case-by-case thing that was provided to us by the medical board for settlements and verdicts over the last 15 years. There was the issue of the number of physicians in the state, and we just had legislative research get something for us. And basically, we talked about this. I mean, the number of physicians in Alaska is inadequate, though it's been growing over the last decade and a half, but still inadequate, and we can argue back and forth why that is. There was debate on what the California statute does, their cap of $250,000. This is my perspective, and it's in this document from the Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights. What we know is that the California cap was adopted in 1975, roughly. It was litigated in the courts until 1986. In 1986, the Supreme Court of California upheld the $250,000 cap. We know that in 1986, malpractice premiums did not go down. In 1987, they went up again. We know that a year after the $250,000 cap was upheld, still malpractice premiums did not go down. As a matter of fact, in 1987, they went up again. In 1988, California voters passed a proposition that said there shall be a reduction in premiums paid, gives the insurance commissioner the right to reject rate increase applications, gives the insurance commissioner the right to lower insurance rates. And then from 1988 on, that's when the California rate reductions occurred. We can argue back and forth what the causal effect was, but I think it seems pretty clear that it wasn't the $250,000 cap that reduced rates in California. I know that Representative Anderson disagrees, and we can have that argument for months and months and months. But let me just see if there's anything else I need to share. Oh, and actually, I asked legislative research to do a calculation for me. At the proposed $250,000 cap that would apply to all cases, including those involving the most serious injuries. We've talked about this. I mean, let's envision somebody with a terribly serious injury, brain injury, paralysis, can't talk, can't lift a child anymore, can't talk to a child anymore, can't fish, can't hike. With a $250,000 cap, what legislative research says that you're doing to somebody who has a 50-year life expectancy is valuing all of that pain, suffering, loss of enjoyment at life at the value of $13.69 a day. And I think that's just the way I look at the $250,000 cap. That's just it's just way too low. So we passed that memo out too, and then I just appreciate that information that we sent around to everybody be placed in the bill file. And that's it. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Guerin. It will be made a part of the bill file. And Representative Holm is back, joining us again.
I'll be in and out.
In and out, in and out. We're just happy you're accommodating us today. Okay, further comments from the committee members? Further discussion? Okay, we have some amendments before us.
May I just have a parliamentary inquiry?
Sure.
Representative Guerra, I assume that these were distributed by you.
Some of them, actually. I think one of them is from Representative Ogg, the one on gross negligence.
I note that there's no A.2, and I'm just wondering if that was a decision not to do that or if I'm missing something.
Representative Ogg, do you know?
No idea why.
I know why. No, I don't know the answer to that. I was willing to make a vote here.
Yeah, let's work through them. So let's look at A.1, Representative Ogg.
It's not mine.
It's not yours. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A.1, that starts out page 2, line 19, following $250,000 and turning that into $1 million. So I offer amendment number 1.
Madam.
There's an objection. Representative Holm.
Yeah, point of order. I have 6 amendments here, and I have 2 that are listed, numbered. I have 1 numbered 1 and number 1 that are
withdrawn. The amendments numbered 1 and 2 have been withdrawn. They were by Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We're on amendment.
Now down to 4.
We are Technically, on amendment, they were never offered. So we'll just call this amendment number one.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Amendment number one by Representative Gira. And there's been an objection noted. Representative Gira.
Thank you. What A1 does is it essentially reinstates the two-tiered damage cap that we have under current law. Current law, the two-tier damage cap is $400,000 or possibly something more for people with a very long life expectancy, except in cases of severe permanent physical impairment or severe disfigurement, it's $1 million or in some very rare cases, over $1 million, depending on the life expectancy. I guess it can go up to $2 million. Amendment number one just says that the new caps, instead of being $400,000 and $1 million, and as we know, those were soft caps because the insurance companies complained that they don't know that those caps applied because the life expectancy option might have applied. But what this does is it gives the insurance companies the certainty they asked for with the hard cap. $250,000, except we use the language from the current law that's been in place, I think, since 1988, that says a higher cap where there's severe permanent physical impairment or severe disfigurement. And in that case, the jury can award up to $1 million for non-economic damages. I can guarantee you it doesn't mean the jury will award the maximum in these cases, but it gives the jury the discretion to award anything up to that amount, and that's really just a matter of the factual circumstances of every case. But I think it just resolves what I see as a great injustice, the way the bill is currently written, and that's just the cases of the severe injuries that we've talked about. I think, for 50-year life expectancy, the sort of idea that we should value those things at $13.69 a day is just too low. So I'd appreciate the committee's support on this two-tiered replacement. It's a little more conservative than what exists under current law, but seems to be a fair compromise.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This is a tough one. I was back in Anchorage for a constituent meeting last week, and I met with Ray Brown, one of the Travelers Association. And like Representative Gira, to a degree, he made a compelling argument. It's a middle ground. I'm not going to say that I'm adamantly opposed to what Representative Gira is saying in the context of the most egregious cases where someone's really disfigured. But the other side of it is, and the reason I sponsored the bill, is that if we're trying to attract new physicians and solidify the insurance market, this would probably prevent that from happening. And again, the refute would be, and Ray Brown said it, and so has Representative Gira, that hey, you're not going to reduce the insurance rates with this bill passing. Prove it. And there's an argument about the $13. And I guess I don't know how much the current is, $400,000. What is that? I mean, $20 a day or 18? I mean, that doesn't sound that much more. The converse would be, as a money manager mentality sort of guy, you invest $250,000 in a money market at 10%, and you have a lot more than that every 7 years. You could look at it where you could really quadruple that money too with the proper investments. And not to make fun of that, but I mean seriously. So there's two different arguments to that about $250,000 and whether that's high or not. The other aspect is that if you talked about in every case that the courts give the deference to the jury. And it's, I guess, my fear in talking with the associations earlier about these amendments, particularly this one, that the insurance companies won't know if the cap is $250,000, this is my fear, or the $1 million until they hear from the jury. And I would think that the association said to protect themselves, the insurance company will then assume every case, as $1 million of exposure. That's my fear. And then, maybe the insurance rates go even higher. And like I say, hearing the people testify and say, oh my God, I'm 70 years old and the pain and suffering, I need to get $1 million because I was really disabled. And hearing doctors saying, I'm leaving, can't recruit, no one else is coming. And insurance companies saying, this could make us reduce rates if you do this. It's a balance. And I'm not saying this amendment is easy to vote on, but I would ask that you vote against it and let us try to recruit more physicians. And again, the cases where this occurs is so minuscule, I think the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, because that's in essence what's going to happen with the vote of this bill. And I think this will recruit more doctors. That's been the message all along, and I'd like to think it would reduce rates. So I would say please vote against the amendment. But I appreciate the effort by Representative Gira.
Representative Holm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a curious anomaly that here I sit and I agree with my good colleague to the left here. It's a rare day that I agree with him. But I do agree with him on this issue. I think one of the things that I've received is our emails that are very compelling with regards to what is $250,000. $250,000 less attorney's fees may be nothing for those that are damaged. And I certainly don't think I want to go through down the road of saying we want to encourage higher attorney fees. And I think Representative Samuels would agree with me there. However, I think that the compensation for malfeasance needs to be greater than $250,000. And in no way could I agree more with Representative Anderson that we want to make sure that we do attract doctors. We certainly do want doctors here, and I don't mean to say we don't. But I think the case has not been made that it's going to increase that doctors will come because it is at $250,000 or if it's at $1 million or whatever it is, nor has the case been made that, to me, sufficiently that there will be any kind of insurance reduction or insurance availability, if you will, even. I'm not sure we'll even have an insurance availability. And as we know, the bigger insurance companies are owned by the doctors themselves. And so I struggle with this as you do, Representative Anderson, but I think I want to fall on the side of those who would be severely damaged through malfeasance and through malpractice. I was listening to an article. Actually, I was reading an article. I'm not listening to it. Reading an article about a fellow who just got an award for $20 million for sniffing popcorn oil for microwave popcorn because he worked in a popcorn factory. And it dawned on me that here is something that somebody could choose to do and still get a jury award that's outrageous, in my opinion. But a huge award, and here we're talking about someone who, through no fault of their own, who say maybe took the information of someone they trusted who could be hurt, and then have very little compensation or recompense for that malfeasance. So I love my doctor. It's got nothing to do with that. But at some point in time, I carry over $1 million liability insurance myself for telling people to get bad plants, you know. So, or if they stumble on my front doorstep. So I just think that the number is so low that it probably is a number. It's been determined that it's probably been a number that's too low for this causation. So that's where I sit with it. So thank you, Madam Chair. I support the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Hunch. Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it's this is a tough amendment. And the fear that I have is, and I know Representative Gere and I disagree on this, of how lawyers sometimes act. Actually, I would assume that five
six, it's only you and me, baby.
disagree on the actions of some lawyers on the threat of coming down with the hammer. That never falls very often because you're so scared that it will. And I said, I know in the industry that I'm familiar with, it's very real that the insurance companies have left. It is very, very real. And companies have stopped flying passengers. And that's okay if there's a lot of people doing that. But it's not okay if you've got one or two physicians in some of the smaller communities across the state. It's not okay because then how do you measure the person who had to catch a medevac flight and he died en route? And that never shows up in the stats because there was no doctor that could do a certain procedure, probably more in a rural area than in my own hometown. But it's a tough amendment. I don't know, also a question for the amendment sponsor. Are there definitions to severe disfigurement, or is it who gets the best lawyer? And you get the best lawyer, and this is severe disfigurement, and this is not. Is it become part of the? Have you not really done anything here? Or permanent physical impairment? I've learned one thing in this committee is you get a room with five lawyers in it, and you could argue over permanent. You could argue for weeks. So questions I have for you, whether those are in statute. And then I said my major concern on the whole thing, I have no illusions that insurance rates aren't going to go down because we do this. That I have no illusions about that. But insurance may disappear, and it may just not be available. And I think that, I said, in the industry that I'm familiar with, it is a very, very real concern as well.
Representative Garrett, did you want to answer that?
In answer to the question on the statutory standard, I thought it was... I thought it would be best to use the standard that's been on the books since, I think since the late 80s, since the first round of tort reform, when we came up with the first dual cap in like 1986, I think. So these are the words that have been used for 15 years. There's one Supreme Court case that addresses it. There are many Superior Court cases. the Superior Court cases they don't have any binding effect on other Superior Court judges. But you're going to have to pick some standard that seems like a reasonable standard. It seems to be time-tested. The truth is, if it's a case where you're not really terribly injured, but you do satisfy the higher standard, you're going to submit the question to the jury. What should this person get in non-economic damages? If it's not a serious case, this is a conservative state, and jury verdicts tend to be conservative, especially in medical malpractice cases in the state. So I don't think you should have any fear that there's going to be an automatic award of $1 million in a case that's not serious. But the words themselves are tailored, I think, narrowly, and frankly, I believe they were tailored by those who pushed the tort reform bill in 1998. So I think they felt that they were narrow, and that's why they drafted them. It's about as narrow and logical a standard as I could come up with, and I felt more comfortable using the one that's been on the books rather than come up with a new one. So.
Hey, Representative Ogg?
Sure. Well, I think I have a very tough time with this also, and I was just looking at it. It's interesting how you can put statistics around, and you take figures, and I just highlighted ones that are over the cap. I'll just go, and these are the early years, and then you just move through time. It's kind of interesting how, I know it's not on the record, we don't have TV, but as you get closer in time in the years, the yellow starts to become a little more predominant.
And so I'm sure for the record, you're saying that it's getting higher.
It seems that there are more higher, and they're not broken out as to pain and suffering. It's just the total claim, and so you don't really know whether it's the early part actual damages or it's pain and suffering included, but the yellow gets more predominant as you go closer in time to where we are today from 91. And the statistics here show that the claims are all within 5 or 10 claims a year, this back and forth past the median, so it's not... So there seems to be an increase, and that concerns me, and I like the concept of the 250. On the other side, I get a little uncomfortable having known people who, have had something happen to them, and I guess the key for me is that you have to go up to that level and prove the negligence. You have to prove the malpractice, and then the standards for malpractice. The million's a little high, but if that's where the amendment's at, I guess I'll go there. But at least it's certain now. It's not. These are the numbers, and we're trying to make this finite and concrete. So I guess that's why I'm a little persuaded.
Madam Chair, on that point,
are
all these that are sorted, are these all jury awards, or are these, these may be agreed to settlements?
They're mostly agreed to settlements. Just statistically, most cases are settled, but they're all of the payments. So some of them are paid after a verdict, some of them are paid after a settlement. But they all have to be reported to the medical board, so the medical board has that information.
Sure. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I think I'm going to go along hesitantly with this amendment.
And any final comments before he wraps up? One of the things I want to be clear in case there's ever a court challenge on this subject, that the record shouldn't be construed to have emphasis on any one thing that anyone has said. It's a comprehensive record that includes hundreds of documents and hundreds of testimony on all sides, and from different groups, whether it's insurance companies or the Alaska Medical Association, or personal testimony from doctors or personal testimony from victims, people who've been injured that don't support it, letters from ARBA, letters from all sorts of different folks. So we are in sort of the final stages of wrap-up, but it should be noted that the attempt to build the record was there. And as Representative Ogg said, you can always go back and forth on statistics, and it's one of the things we just don't know. We don't have a crystal ball. We know that we look at California, and 1976 was when MICRA was enacted, and then we know there's a court challenge, so roughly 86 by the time it came into effect, that their costs have increased only 100%, while nationwide costs excluding California have increased by over 563%. And we had testimony early on this bill about that. So while we don't know and can't prove that this particular bill will keep the two insurance companies, medical malpractice providers in the state, and hopefully attract more physicians, we can't prove that. We have attempted to look to other jurisdictions to see what they've done, and California being the model for the $250,000 cap that appears to work, at least in part. And Representative Guerra brought up the ballot initiative, and that may have a part of it too. This is a really difficult issue, and I want to declare on the record I have a physician father, and so that's a conflict for me, perceivably. But
you want an objection?
Yeah, okay. I do. Thanks. But what's interesting is talking to my dad. You know, Dad isn't somebody that really falls into these categories per se. So, not supporting this bill to benefit him. I am looking at the overall health of the medical industry in the state of Alaska, and I know that we are getting close to a crisis. We are not the only state that has reached that point, but I think it's incumbent upon us to try to do something. The other thing that's important to remember is that when we're talking about the cap, we're talking about non-economic damages, and that's really important. We're not talking about compensatory damages, which would be things like your medical bills, your out-of-pocket expenses. It would include things like travel for treatment to a place that you might need treatment if you couldn't get it in Alaska, lost rate wages, and so on. And so we're not talking about that. We're talking about non-economic damages. And then I think, you know, Representative Samuels and I had an interesting conversation. What I understand to happen, I don't practice, and I don't spend a lot of time looking at this area, but it's similar to what happens in aviation suits and others, is that the liability has to be projected for the amount of which it's possible to recover on. So it really doesn't matter that there are all kinds of charts and statistics that show that Alaska juries are more conservative, for example. Anchorage juries, anyway. We know that they are, and yet that doesn't factor in actuarially. What happens is that insurance companies have to look at the entire amount that is possible to recover. And so if it's $1 million that's possible, then it's $1 million that's factored in. And that's the problem with the amendment, in my opinion. The next part is that the definitions of serious physical impairment and disfigurement are not defined, and I understand the reluctance to define them here because they appear in common law. But I would also note that in other pieces of legislation before this committee, you were probably one of the first people to jump up and want it specifically defined in the statute so that it couldn't be interpreted any other way, and no different than I've been in that position myself. So it all depends on where you're sitting. And my concern is that in talking with healthcare professionals, these terms have been interpreted more loosely than I think we would envision. I mean, when we talk about disfigurement, I think we're talking about severe burns, we're talking about loss of a limb, we're talking about the kinds of things that are so life-altering that you would expect a different level. And yet, that's not what happens. The other practical thing that we know that happens is that most cases, it's only 6% that ever go to trial. So most cases are borne out through settlements, and settlements do occur very often. And we don't have statistics on the settlements. We have statistics on the trials and on what comes out of a jury. And where the real costs come into play are the settlements. The fact that you have that exposure sitting out there and a lawsuit's brought against you, and you've got to face that challenge or that question about whether you want to spend at a minimum $10,000 to defend yourself to get in the door or not. And by the way, we all understand that the insurance company gets to make that decision too. So it isn't even the case that the physician can say, I want to go all the way, this is an injustice. You know, I am a good physician and this lawsuit is being brought against me unfairly. And so if NorCal is your medical malpractice provider and they decide that it's more cost effective to settle, then so be it. And everybody pays the cost of settlements. We have to understand that in all industries, and healthcare is no different. So it isn't just the statistics regarding the trial outcomes, it's the fact that settlements are so common. And then finally, I want to say on the record a line of questioning that I went into with every single medical malpractice attorney that came online, plaintiff's attorney, if you will. And I asked them questions about contingency fees, and I asked questions about costs. And I understand that it's illegal to include the costs of hiring experts and things like that as a part of the percentage. That said, I hope for anyone listening or on the record, you know, the feds have said that it's 20%. It's 20%, and that's the maximum amount of a contingency fee, unless it's 30 days before trial. Then it's 25%. And I considered putting that into this bill of Representative Anderson's and decided that they're probably already going to run a candidate against me, and I would just seal my fate even further. So I've chosen not to do that. But I think that that has to be addressed as well. Representative Holm is just right. After you pay out 35% in contingency fees and $50,000 or so in costs, what does that leave the person who who's been injured? Not a lot. So I would encourage the trial bar to think about that too. And I've heard what I believe is genuine concern on their part about these innocent victims and the types of things they've seen, and perhaps they want to step up to the plate and lower their contingency fees as the bar. I think that would be admirable. I think 20% of $250,000 is a lot of money, and it's more money than some people make in a year, and it's certainly enough. That said, I won't go on and on, but I think it is important, as I said before, if there's ever a legal challenge, that there are documents in here, and I went way beyond the amendment itself because I don't intend to talk again. So I appreciate the latitude of the committee, but I believe in effect that this amendment would gut the goal of the bill. The goal of the bill is to reduce the amount of exposure that is out there and to reduce the amount of settlements that are occurring, because 94% of them will be settled. And so with that, I've stated my apparent, sort of odd when you're, you have parents and grandparents and things that live in the same state. I guess you have a lot of potential conflicts, but that is
even when they don't.
Even when they don't. That's right. So thanks for the latitude, and I'll let Representative Anderson wrap up.
Be glad your parents are still alive.
That's right. That's a very good point, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in wrap up, like I say, it's a balance, and we've talked outside of the committee, and the travelers bring good arguments, and I have to weigh as the facilitator of this legislation on the and I say this to Representative Holm in particular, to the hospital in his district, to the hospital near my district, from Providence to Regional, to Fairbanks, to the physicians and surgeons association, to the medical association, and they seem to think that this will work. I'd like to say that both entities aren't self-serving. You could argue that, but I think they're both passionate in their arguments, and that's where I would wish you'd weigh. But I also understand your argument and trial lawyer's argument. But I would ask that you oppose.
Madam Secretary, any comments? Just thought I'd give you a chance. She has to listen to us every day, biting her teeth. Any further comments, Representative Garrett? Your amendment. Do you want to wrap up on your?
Yeah, I would just say the other important reason for this amendment is that a lot of people don't get anything outside of non-economic damages. Sure, you get your medical expenses, but those have to go to. I mean, you get medical expenses because you have to pay them to a physician or to a hospital to pay for your injury. Then you might get lost wages, but the truth is that senior citizens who are injured don't get lost wages because you only get lost wages for your projected working life, and if you've stopped working, that lost wages aren't available to you. Arguably, subsistence people, I think there's case law on this. I don't know whether or not people who lead a subsistence lifestyle get lost wages. I forget. Lost wages aren't available to a lot of people. And so you take this $250,000 cap and you reduce it by a third because it's taxable, and you reduce it by another third because you have to pay your attorney's fees, and there's very little left. So I think the $250 million dual cap is a compromise. It does provide the insurance companies with a hard cap, so they don't have to worry about the sort of soft cap that exists under current law. That's it. We've heard the arguments.
Okay. Representative Anderson, do you maintain your objection?
Yes, I do.
Madam Secretary, will you please call the roll on amendment number one?
Representative Guerra.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Ogg.
Yes.
Representative Holm.
Yes.
Representative Samuels.
No.
Representative McGuire.
No.
4 yes, 3 nay.
And so amendment number one carries. That brings us to amendment number two, which is A.3. And is this Representative Ogg or Representative Garris? Representative Ogg.
I'll
object. I would move the amendment.
There's been an objection. Representative Ogg.
This amendment will add language on page 2. In two places, on line 22, after death, language limits on damage in this subsection do not apply if the personal injury or wrongful death was a result of gross negligence or reckless or intentional misconduct. And then similar language on line 25 after the word judgment. I had talked with some folks, and a lot of the insurance companies, they don't cover people for this type of activity. Act grossly negligent or reckless disregard, they cover for the negligence. Regardless of that fact, what we would be doing here in statute, when we put this together, we would be letting these folks off. And consistently this session, I have been wanting to make sure that these folks are accountable for the damage that they do. And so that's why these exceptions are submitted as an amendment.
Representative Anderson?
No, I've spoke with the associations, and they feel that the amendment is irrelevant because, and irrelevant may be the wrong word, but because punitive damages apply in these cases of gross negligence or reckless or intentional damages. And it was noted by someone that currently, I was told, 50% of punitive damages go to the state. And so it's believed that what this is, it's an attempt to get around perhaps that arrangement. I'm not sure what they meant by that. But basically, the individuals that support the bill feel that this does not need to be corrected, and there are adequate remedies currently in the statute. So based on their analysis, I would not concur with the amendment.
Representative Gruenberg?
Just to respond to that one point. Punitive damages
are really extraordinary. They're not often awarded, and they really almost require, I think, a separate phase of the trial in many cases, and I'm not sure about that. But they have to be proven by clear and convincing evidence, for one thing. And it's a much higher standard of proof. So they really are not a substitution for this. And I'd ask Representative Guerra, is there not usually a separate phase for punitive damages?
I think the answer to Representative Anderson's question is this would say in the actual damages phase, if you're, I guess, grossly negligent or worse, the caps don't apply. Separately, you would have the punitive damages question. So by adding this section, you wouldn't be reducing the punitive damages and then thereby reducing the take the state gets. Those are just two separate questions. So the punitive damages amount would stay the same, and the state would get its 50% share of that amount. It wouldn't change. These are two separate types of damages. And sometimes you do it. I think sometimes you do what's called a bifurcated trial. You do liability, then you do punitive damages. But you're not required to do that. So it varies case to case.
The section covering punitive damages under civil damages and apportionment of fault is Section 9, Title 9, 17020, and talks about when punitive damages will be awarded, and it's just as Representative Gruenberg said, that it's the fact finder may make an award of punitive damages only if the plaintiff proves by clear and convincing evidence that the defendant's conduct was outrageous, including acts done with malice or bad motives, or evidenced reckless indifference to the interests of another person. At a separate proceeding to determine the amount of punitive damages to be awarded, the fact finder may consider. And then there are a series of considerations, seven all told, but there are things like the amount of financial gain the defendant gained or expected to as a result of the defendant's conduct, the duration of the conduct and any intentional concealment of it, the attitude and conduct of the defendant upon discovery of the conduct itself, and so on, up to and including the financial condition of the defendant, his or herself.
Because that's not normally admissible.
Representative Anderson.
I just want to comment, though, and just so Representative Guerra here is real quick, Les. Just what concerns me with this is, again, and it comes down to the ceiling aspect and the idea you could use a lot of different analogies. Someone, a surgeon, says, hey, I've got a hybrid or a different type of surgery I think I could perform, and maybe other doctors assisting say, no, you need to stick with the books, and he or she says, no, but I think this could work, and damage is done, and there's no cap, and $10 million later for pain and suffering, and under this, construed as reckless disregard, he or she says, no, my intent was to help, it wasn't reckless disregard, no, it comes across, at least a jury's perspective, reckless disregard, maybe we agree with that, maybe we don't, and, you know, who knows? You just said there's no ceiling, and that's now my fairness cap comes out and says that's not fair. I know you can give the other an example of an egregious act, but that's what concerns me.
I think you meant to direct that to Representative Ogg.
That's right. I assume every amendment is a Representative Guerra amendment.
Well, sorry, Representative Ogg?
I know there's other cases in different fields that we've come up against, and I've asked for this because I just don't think that when somebody's conduct gets to that level that we should be opening up a protection device for them, that they should be subject to the present law. And what these two lines do, it says if you rise to that level, so you have a drinking problem and you decide to go in and do surgery, you shouldn't have a limit here. Somebody who's just negligent, you know, doesn't go to that higher level of drinking and then going in. And there are cases, you know, that have dealt with these things in other fields. I just don't feel it's right to let those kind of folks off. And the insurance companies, I don't believe they insure for this kind of conduct. So they're not going to be covered under insurance. And it's that person against, you know, the rules of the state. And I just feel strongly that when somebody has that kind of conduct, we should not be protecting them.
One of the questions, I don't know, but Representative Ogg, isn't it? I mean, by definition, if you're making a medical malpractice claim, I suppose you could bring one on simple negligence, but I'd be curious to know what percentage of the claims are brought with the mental intent of simple negligence versus gross negligence, reckless or intentional misconduct. My point simply being, now that Amendment number one has carried, you are back to essentially a $1 million cap. We can disagree about how it will be applied or not. I think the common law interpretation of serious physical injury is broad enough to assume that people will factor $1 million in, and settlements will be adjusted accordingly, based upon people's unwillingness to go through a trial and pay the costs. That said, now what we're talking about is excluding those higher mental intents, and I know what you're getting at, and I know that we've talked about it in other areas. But do you happen to know, in those cases, which are brought on the mental intent of simple negligence versus the other, on a percentage?
Well, in this list here, they weren't identified out.
Representative Guerra?
The answer to that is apart from the punitive damages phase, all claims are brought on a simple negligence, and there's also the informed consent issue, but put that to the side. So put punitive damages and informed consent to the side. All medical malpractice cases are brought on a simple negligence theory. It wouldn't do you any good to plead gross negligence. I mean, because you just have to prove under a lack of negligence that was a violation of the standard of care that doctors are supposed to follow in a particular area. So you would never find out which cases involved gross negligence, because you only have to prove negligence to be entitled to basic damages.
So after this, though, there would be an incentive.
This would be new. This would have a.
It would be an incentive to
a separate
argue
claim.
The higher levels, knowing that the caps would be out. One final thought, and then we can go back to it. I think that given the fact that the caps are lifted up, we should reject this amendment. I think it opens it up too far. Again, it's not what's proved; it's what's alleged. It's what brings people into the phase of negotiations toward a settlement to begin with. And a clever lawyer, I would think, could easily argue gross negligence at a minimum for somebody who's had a medical misfortune, if you will. The other thing that I think is important to bring up is that we do have and are not affecting punitive damages in this bill. The way that others have. I mean, other states have chosen different approaches to tackling it. And the punitive damages part is the part where you're trying to deter conduct. And it's the kind of thing that you're talking about here, where somebody has intentionally disregarded a known risk. And I think that when it comes to compensatory damages, we all understand what they are. And they aren't going to change whether or not someone's mental intent is different or not. I mean, those are lost wages, those are medical bills and things like that, meaning you're not going to have more medical bills or less medical bills or so on. In the case of non-economic damages, it's been stated, at least on the record, that the goal is to get at loss of consortium, loss of enjoyment of life, these types of things, and then possibly it's used as a method of granting some recovery to the elderly or others who don't have the ability to recover under an economic damages basis. But I think we're mixing apples and oranges here. I think when you're talking about someone's mental intent rising to that level, you ought to be talking about punitive damages, and it's a separate consideration. And so I'll oppose the amendment. Representative Samuels, and then I'll let you wrap up. Is that okay? Let everyone talk. Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a question for Representative Ogg. Is there a cap on this right now? Is the cap the same? It's a $2 million cap. So you're taking away the $2 million, even for, I mean, obviously in the intentional misconduct, and somebody goes in there purposely cuts the wrong foot off.
There's only the present law that's the case.
What's that?
There's only the present law that's the case.
So the present law, that's capped at $2 million. So the amendment takes away even the present cap. And
I'm not that mean a guy, but I do feel strongly about this.
I'd be curious the same thing that Representative McGuire asked is normally where do the suits fall in? And I'll go back to my earlier example, the same question on when you argue between simple negligence and gross negligence, do you end up in a contest of who hired the better lawyer? You know, if you get into the intentional, I don't think there'd be any argument on that, but I doubt if there's that many lawsuits for that. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but so I'm curious, do you know, is this covered under the punitive damage portion of it? You answered the cap already, and then I have the same queasiness with the whole thing on the negligence to gross negligence, proving a standard to a bunch of people in a jury that don't know anything about the law or medicine, and whoever has the best lawyer talks his way up the ladder. So that's my concern with it. But.
Yeah.
I guess the sense is being a little more draconian than perhaps the present law, but I really have a problem with the folks who rise to that higher level, and I think we need to rein it in somewhat. And I think when you do this, it's not the punitive part. It's certainly not the punitive part. That's separate. You know, that's the higher, a separate category. When somebody comes in and they make the claim that it's gross negligence, my understanding, and perhaps I'm wrong, but the insurance companies don't cover for that. So when that's claimed, then you're outside of the insurance. And so your concern about raising the hammer on people and the insurance company, people just go, they go for the deep pocket. I don't think it fits under this.
Okay.
Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Sorry, my last comment was just in response to somebody else's question. You know, the only medical malpractice case I ever took as an attorney involved intentional misconduct. And I will tell you that other members of the medical community gave me a sort of congratulations, I'm glad you did that after the case was done. It was an awful case. The woman was not as badly injured as some of the people that we've heard about during the testimony here. She went in for her ear condition, and the undisputable truth about her ear condition was it might have gotten worse if she let it go on. It probably would have gotten worse, but the truth is that ear condition is something called otosclerosis. It's something that some people decide just to let it get worse, and at some point they can have surgery later on. The surgery is no more dangerous or no less successful later on than it is right now. But the doctor, and I think just because of his belief in how good surgery can be, recommended that she have surgery now and told her, just as he tells all of his patients with that condition, you need to have the surgery now because if I do it later, it might not be as successful. But the truth was, if you did it later, the chances of success were exactly the same. And so the patient had the surgery. The surgery went terribly. And an eardrum was essentially punctured, and she became very dizzy afterwards. And it was a pretty miserable condition for her. And I thought to myself, you know, in most malpractice cases, it's just negligence. And what we're saying is that in American society, we say if you hurt somebody by exercising unreasonable care, you should compensate that person. But at some point, your conduct becomes so egregious that I think there's no reason why society should protect you. And that's how I felt about this physician. There was no reason why society should protect somebody who has not been giving people fair information about the risks of surgery and the need for surgery for so long. And and the other thing I would share on that case is it was clearly a case that I could have I could have qualified for the $2 million cap on. And I would say that I feel comfortable in saying that I worked for one of the best law firms in the town at the time. And as good a law firm as I worked for at the time, and as readily available as the $1 million, $2 million cap was, at first the insurance company for the first year and a half of the case offered a settlement amount of $20,000. And what gets lost in all this discussion is that tends to be the practice in these cases. Until the eve of trial, you get a very small settlement offer. And the idea, I think, the strategy is we want to deter people from filing claims, so we'll run them through the ringer if they file them. On the eve of trial, the case settled for about $300,000, as I recall. So I had a case that qualified for the $1 million or $2 million cap, And there's been some discussion about once you qualified for that cap, you get the money. I've got to say, I worked for what I would consider to be one of the best law firms in town, with some of the brightest people in town, with actually the best trial lawyer in town. And so the threat was that we were going to go to trial with the best trial lawyer in the city, and the best we could do in a settlement was about $300,000. It turned out I think that was a fair settlement, frankly. But it's not like people hand out money to you just because you qualify for the higher cap. You take into account what a jury is likely to do when they see the evidence and they see your client and they see the extent of the injuries. So. I think ultimately there are some classes of conduct that, as a legislature, we probably shouldn't protect. So I think I agree with Representative Ogg.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah, I don't practice in this area. I took a case once. The client did not reveal the full truth, and we dropped it. That wasn't a divorce either. No, that was a medical mal. So I can't say I'm much of an expert in this, but I can see, looking at the list that's attached to the handout that Representative Garrett gave out, there are a number of things that are clearly negligent here. But then there are some that appear to be really fall into the ambit of Representative Ogg's amendment. And I'm going to just point out one. Happens to be a very fine doctor, happens to be my doctor, actually. He's down at the bottom of page one, Dr. Vasilev, and the allegation was arthroscope wrong knee, which looks like he operated on the wrong knee. And that's fairly serious. But there was only 45,000 there. The point being that even if there's something that's serious problem, and that may or may not have been, but you don't always get a lot of money, but you know, these things do happen and they vary. And I'm in a profession that gets sued too. You know, you live by the sword and you die by the sword. And I've got to say, we've been sued, not successfully, fortunately. Well, once we settled it, it's what's ever fair. You know, we want to be fair in this life.
Okay, I have been told by Vanessa that someone flew in today, and I didn't know that, for House Bill number 339. So my apologies. So we're going to go ahead and set this aside. Madam Secretary, we're in the middle of Amendment number 2, offered by Representative Ogg and objected to, and we're in the middle of debate on that. So we'll set this aside and pick back up at that spot. Okay, House Bill 339. I'll go ahead and just start. It's a bill by Representative Meyer. I'm going to go ahead and get to Mr. Flint. My apologies.
Do you want us to adopt the CS here?
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay, I'll move the adoption of the S, as in Sierra version.
S?
Yes. Yeah. The blank CS. Dated 3-5, it suggests.
Does everybody have that?
For discussion only.
Any objection?
Yeah.
No S objection, version. I'm looking for it. S version?
Yeah. It's behind a memo on anybody. Rep. Meyer's letterhead.
I've got it.
Okay, any objection to that motion to adapting version S? Hearing none, we have version S before us.
Well, first of all, I appreciate the chair's consideration, but I must say I always enjoy coming down to Juneau and spending time around the halls. So.
Your name, sir, please?
Robert Flint, and I'm an attorney in Anchorage for Harding, Rhodes, Hoagie, and Leakage. And for House Bill 339, I'm here representing direct marketing and publishers. These are a large group of people who conduct business through the mail, the internet, and telephone, selling products, a lot of which you're familiar with, fills up your mailbox probably, magazines, Book of the Month Club, and that sort of thing, CDs, videos, and the like. I'm retained by a firm in Virginia called DeHart & Darr. It's not a law firm, but they represent the direct marketers and publishers nationwide to follow legislation, obviously both at the Federal Trade Commission level and at the state level. So that's how I am involved in that regard. The industry here is regulated in significant respects by the Federal Trade Commission, both on telemarketing and aspects of mail, and also
at the state level in various ways, particularly in Alaska, for example. There's an unsolicited merchandise act governing things you might receive in the mail without soliciting them or without agreeing to them, and it's considered a free gift. The industry is large and diverse and old. It's been around a long time. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. Its basic advantage, obviously, for books and magazines to the business is they have that way to sell to the public to boost up their subscription rates. And for the consumer, it's a discounted value because they're usually accompanied by promotions, including the free trial type, which is what I'm going to talk about right now. House Bill 339 works arises, as I understand it, out of certain circumstances from last year, and also complaints through the Attorney General's office on various complaints through the Fair Business Practices section of the Attorney General's office. We've been working with my clients and Representative Meyer's office and the Attorney General's office, I think, diligently on both sides to try to come to a draft bill which will work to protect what are the problems that are perceived and allow the vast majority of the honest and legitimate business folks to go about doing this type of promotion. I'm not sure we're exactly there yet. We've come a long way. We've been trading back and forth amendments even today up to 1 o'clock. So if you'll forgive me that you know I can't put a complete stamp on it, but I think everybody's worked very hard, and I would say right off the bat that the direct marketers are not interested in stopping state legislation or correcting problems. In fact, legitimate people always want to go after the problems, after all, because they're the ones that get splashed with the mud, even though they're maybe doing the correct thing. Let me just go to one section after we pass back amendments and language back and forth. And one of the sections we're hung up with now, and I don't know, there are some proposed amendments. Suzanne, they're going to be passed out, or should I? Okay. And what I'm speaking to is not probably what you have in front of me in the printed version, but some suggested amendments which have come from my clients in large part and have been changed a little bit by the Attorney General's office, which creates a problem. And I guess this is a good example of the type of thing we have to try to fit together. We're dealing largely with the question of free trial offers via the telephone. The sections in the bill regulate both inbound and outbound calls. Outbound calls are the ones that we all love to hate. Those are the telemarketers that call you up at dinner time and offer to sell you something. These calls are regulated by Federal Trade Commission rules and also, of course, by the Do Not Call list at the federal level, which now has 57 million names on it. I suspect that cold call sales telephonic marketing is probably going to decline rapidly because that list is now upgradable every 90 days, and at Congress's insistence is going to be upgraded every 30 days, and I assume that 57 million will call will rise dramatically. So, of course, the first defense of any consumer who doesn't want that sort of thing is, by golly, get on your list. But we're also dealing with the inbound calls, which is not covered by the Do Not Call list, and that's a customer who originates the call in response to an ad, or calls to existing customers, people who are already on the business's list and have purchased products or dealt with them before. We have in the amendment a subsection E.
Amendment?
I'm sorry. It's there was one handed out to you. It looks like this, I believe.
They handed two out.
Two of them out.
One that is page 2, line 3, or page 28.
Page 2, line 16. Oh, I'm sorry. Page 2, line 3 is the one, and down at the bottom is page 2, line 16. Insert new subsection E.
Okay, so this is.
Okay, please continue.
Okay, thank you. There are two stages involved in the telemarketing for free trial offers. Stage one, I believe that we have come to acceptable language on, and that is the call and the promotion itself. And in that, the requirements there are that the seller disclose certain items, including the charges, cancellation policy, and so forth, that the customer agrees, express consent to the promotion, and that in all cases, both on the disclosure and in the agreement, the burden of proof is on the seller to show that those the disclosures have been complied with and that the agreement is there. That does not appear to be a problem. But then at stage two, what the go to billing or then what you what follows on, say, in the mail, the clients proposed the list of four items you see here as alternatives. The Attorney General would prefer that you do all of them. The problem is that the business doesn't do all of them. For example, if you look on this list of four items, if the customer chooses to be billed by credit card or chooses to give their credit card, they would obviously not receive an invoice because they have already paid. So the fact of the matter is on the ground that that flexibility of the alternatives is what the business needs at this stage two, where we feel we've complied with the disclosures, certainly, and also that the customer always has the right, dissatisfied or not, whether it's with the disclosures or anything else, or he doesn't like the product, is to cancel it. And the cancellation, by the way, to describe the practicality of it, the great majority of free trial promotions are canceled. It is not an unusual situation. Most of them end up being canceled after the free trial period or during the free trial period. So that's just a regular cost of doing business. So it's trying to fit the legitimate concerns, which we totally agree with, into business practices that occur nationwide. It's a complicated problem. It's a diverse industry. There are various methods used to use it. There are regulations at the Federal Trade Commission level. So I'm not saying this is easy to do. We are working diligently and will continue to work diligently to help get this bill through. We do have some difficulties, and I believe at this stage of the game, I just wanted to tell you we're working up to 1 o'clock, and we will continue to do so, and I think we can. But we're still trying to fit a few things together. So that would be the only comment I would have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Flint. Questions for Mr. Flint? Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Flint, I've got, I think, actually I need some more time to read the amendments. But I don't have a big problem with the concept with one tweet. That is that with a lot of these free offers that you get, there are two problems. One is, you forget the rules that you were told on how you cancel, right? I mean, you're told you can cancel any time, and you forget the magic word that you're supposed to use and when you're supposed to use it and that sort of stuff. The other is that sometimes you have to use the magic word, and then you have to dial a telephone number that only works while you're at work. And so then you can't get in touch with the person, assuming that you can't make the phone call from work. And it gets really frustrating for people. First, you got to remember the magic safe word, and then the second is you have to remember the you have to remember to call during work when some people can't call during work, and so that's a good protection for many people in many circumstances. But to be perfectly fair to people, and I've always thought this myself when I've received these free offers, I would like to receive a billing before my billing is due. Maybe you'll take a paper one. And on the paper billing, I would like it to have a box or something that clearly tells me how I cancel this offer so I don't get charged something. Because I don't remember the directions and I don't remember the phone number, and frankly, I have a real hard time making phone calls during the workday. So what I would like to see, and I've got a proposed amendment to deal with this, is not just this right to cancel by telephone, but also I would like to see a paper remittance that you could send in that tells you how to cancel, that you can send in to cancel. Then I don't think I have a problem with this. Without that, I do have a problem with the bill. I wonder if you might be able to work with me in addressing that problem.
Well, I think there are a couple of points that I'd like to make, and one problem that is going to exist. The first thing, it does not appear from the volume of people who cancel these things that there's a persistent problem out there. I've asked, the Attorney General apparently has statistical information on the complaints that come in related to this area, and I've asked for them because I would like myself to quantify exactly what the problem is. I know that my client just yesterday, as we were talking and was reviewing some of these things, called up the marketing person for Time Magazine to talk about a big one, and he says, we get them by the thousands, cancellations all the time. So it's my perception that the problem in quantity is not that big. The difficulty in putting on extra obligations, the Attorney General asked about requiring an 800 number, is that it may be all right for the big guys. It is not going to be all right for the little guys. In this group of people, you not only have the Time magazines and the Wall Street journals, but you have the special interest magazines, for example. The example used on our conference call yesterday was Archaeology Today or the Mayo Clinic Health Newsletter. There's a lot of small stuff out there that is are in niche markets. And they, quite frankly, and to the response to that question, can't afford the 800 lines nationwide. And if you put on an extra mailing or something like that, you're adding a cost to them, which, after all, is a cost to the consumer and raises it for everybody. And one of the advantages of this type of system is that it is discounted. If you take one of these offers, if it's a magazine you like, for example, the most expensive subscription you can get is the sending back the little card that drops out of the magazine when you pick it up out of the on the newsstand. You know, there are about three or four of them. I can consistently pick up the magazine, looking at it, and picking up the trash that's come out of the thing. But if you send one of those, that's most expensive. To get it is the free trial offer is the cheapest. But if you're going to add on, especially in these small outfits, they may not either able to bear the burden or in some cases pass it on. So I think, you know, in all these things, the practical deal is what cost are we raising to everybody, can we quantify the objections, and are they that persistent and pervasive so that, you know, we have to raise the cost. So practicality is important here. Cost is important to the consumer.
Other questions? Hey, Representative Meyer. Thank you for flying in from Anchorage.
Thank you for taking me.
Representative Meyer, welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's good to be back. This is a
long time.
Favorite committee, right?
It's another
one of my favorite. How's that?
I started to join us for an afternoon.
Suzanne's written a script for him. He's reading.
And I apologize for my delay, but had to make a quorum up in finance. So, but Madam Chair, this is a totally different bill than the previous one, and I think this is one that the whole committee is going to like. It truly is a consumer protection bill. And even if the bill doesn't pass, it's definitely helping the Alaska economy. I was when I introduced this bill, I didn't know I was going to attract a lot of big or back east interest. And since they hired a local attorney and a local lobbyist, which that's great. Just to kind of give you an outline of the bill, and I know Mr. Flint has already done that, and we have worked with Mr. Flint and his law firm as well as. Mr. Dawson, and we have come a long ways, and I do think we are pretty close. And Ed Sniffen is on the line, and he'll give us his opinion. And he's really the one that I'm most interested in because he's the one that has to prosecute these cases. But this bill is broken up into two different parts. It has to do with two business practices, and both of them probably are at times very annoying. One has to do with the free trial period. And the other one has to do with the opt-out marketing plan. It's going to require them to fully disclose to the consumers what is involved with the. I'll start with the free trial period, they have to disclose all the terms and conditions of the free trial period if indeed you want to do this, what the consumer obligations are during the free trial and after the free trial period. And if you do accept the product after the free trial period, what your obligations are as far as what the charge is going to be, and all the requirements that they have to meet are in this bill. As far as the opt-out, I think all of you are familiar with this. And actually, this came to my attention by a constituent, and I think probably many of you got calls from constituents on this. It was last year, one of the telephone companies offered a new feature on your cell phone, and it was just, you automatically got it unless you told them you didn't no longer want it. And Madam Chair, I think you have found, as I, that it's a lot easier to sign up for a service than it is to get out of a service. And as I think Representative Guerra was saying, sometimes it's not so easy, even if you remember to opt out, to get a hold of the right person to do that. So out of the frustration that my constituent had, and many constituents, that's one of the reasons why we are bringing this forward. And actually, just to personalize it a little bit, I was all of a sudden receiving a billing on my credit card, $6 a month, for some travel service that I didn't even remember that I had signed up for. And apparently, the best I can tell is that one of the travel agents I had used had given this agency my credit card. And apparently, I had use of this free travel service for 30 days unless I opted out, and I didn't opt out. So I was just automatically getting billed, and you get so many charges, or I do, unfortunately, between me and my wife, on my credit card that I didn't even pick up the $6 a month until about 4 months later. And so then when I tried to cancel or get out, it was a nightmare. And by the time I got out, I had 5 months of charges, and then they would not credit the previous four. They did.
I'm sure as Representative Meyer referring to his Club Med members.
No.
Signed up
together with. No. Anyway, that's what the opt out is that you get these goods and services, and unless you take action, you automatically get charged for it. And unfortunately, what's happened is that this has increased in popularity, not only with the phone companies and travel services, but a lot of businesses are using this because this is a way to get their product out to people. And they know that we're all busy. Some of us have two or three jobs. Some of us have kids running around to the soccer and the school. And we're going to forget to opt out. And we're going to forget to call. Or we might say, gee, it's only $6 a month. Okay, I'll go ahead and keep it. Well, that way they got another sale. And frankly, I just don't think that that's right and proper way to do business. And so that's why we're bringing this this bill forward. It prohibits an opt-out marketing plan unless it's fully disclosed to the consumer what you have to do and by what time. And it kind of shifts a more responsibility on these businesses to make a more of a concerted effort to disclose everything to the consumer before they give us this free trial or they give us this opt-out plan. And frankly, Ms. Madam Chair, I think that is proper. These businesses, they want us to have their product, they want to sell the product to us, and the least they can do is disclose what the ramifications are, what the obligations are. And as I said, we've worked very closely with the Department of Law, and they're very interested in this because they have received numerous complaints about these type of business practices. And certainly, Madam Chair, I'm very flexible in working with the outfit back east and the local attorneys in trying to come up with a compromise, but I still want to make sure that that our constituents, our consumers, are fully protected in the process.
Hear, hear. Okay, questions for Representative Meyer? Any questions? Representative Holm, didn't you have?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I was just through the chair. Representative Meyer, with the opt-out portion of this, I understand the cancellation portion of it. But my question would be, when you get a billing, let's say for a magazine subscription, why couldn't that billing have just a box in it where you could check it and opt out of it instead of getting it on and getting it and getting it and getting it and getting it? I mean, it wouldn't take a rocket scientist to figure out I do not want to continue receiving it. I mean, could we? I guess it's interstate commerce, so it's probably not something we would do, but I don't know. It seems like there might be a simpler fix to this than bill. I don't know.
Well, Representative Holmes, Madam Chair, I think, and I haven't looked at Representative Guerra's amendment too close, but I think that may be where he's going. And we are limited to some extent by federal law and interstate commerce, as you mentioned. But certainly there, we do have some room to make our own restrictions at the state level. I would like to refer that again to Ed Sniffen to answer, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Any further questions for Representative Meyer? Okay, we have Mr. Ed Sniffen on the line in Anchorage with the Department of Law. Are you there, Mr. Sniffen?
Yes, I can, Madam Chair. Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
My name is Ed Sniffen with the Department of Law here in Anchorage, and thank you for the opportunity to comment on this bill. And we certainly support Representative Meyer's efforts to deal with this free trial period and opt-out marketing situation. And there are a number of reasons why this kind of legislation, I think, would help consumers understand obligations that they undertake when they respond to these kinds of offers. And these are the kinds of offers that are the most enticing to consumers. And you will note the legislation is really only directed at the free trial offer or the opt-out plan. You know, direct sales aren't a problem. You know, I'm going to call you up. I have this product. You want to buy it? Yes or no? No. Okay. See you later. You know, that's not the deal. This legislation is directed at, you know, the kind of offer that people just simply don't refuse or don't want to refuse. This creates fertile ground for all kinds of potential deceptions because it's easy to say on the phone to someone, oh, sure, I'm going to get it for free. It's no obligation for me. I'll take this thing. And then, you know, if I don't want it later, I can, you know, cancel. And everyone thinks it's easy to cancel. Well, and as Representative Guerra pointed out, a lot of telemarketers have phone lines that really only go one way. They make outgoing calls, but, you know, they can't take incoming calls. So ability to cancel these services in the same manner in which they are sold is not available in a lot of circumstances. So the original intent of the bill, I believe, from our perspective, was to require some kind of a written confirmation from the consumer that they, in fact, agree to this deal, whatever the deal is. And we had suggested that that written confirmation be obtained from the consumer before the product or service was provided or at least billed for. And the response we got from the Direct Marketing Association essentially was that would create an economic burden that would really be unfair, and that there might be other ways to address this problem by requiring some disclosures over the phone or sending out a written confirmation of the sale that the consumer could review and then send back in the event it didn't comport with their understanding. And you know, I couldn't agree more with Representative Guerra's comments about how, you know, people tend to forget what they say on the phone. And these phone transactions are very interesting, to say the least, but they're targeted at elderly folks who a lot of times don't remember what they said, or even not so elderly folks like myself who don't remember sometimes what we say. And to get something in writing to at least confirm what you've agreed to, and if it's not what you agreed to, give you the ability to say, no, I don't want this deal anymore, is, I think, what we'd like to see in this legislation. And the way the bill was originally drafted, which I played a significant role in drafting, you know, contained some fairly strict requirements for obtaining that kind of consent up front. And we have worked with Mr. Flint and his client, Ms. Darr, to come up with some compromise language that would still achieve the goal of making sure that the telemarketers or direct marketers, it's not just limited to telephone sales, it's ads on late night TV, it's mailers you get, and it's all kinds of barrage of consumer you know, media that you might respond to. And we had a consumer file a complaint this year who responded to a Focus Factor ad on TV, you know, for these vitamins, and it was free for 30 days, just paid $4.95 shipping or handling. And she called us, you know, this number up, this 800 number, and they said, oh, sure, give us your credit card for the $4.95. And she does, and they said, okay, we're going to put you on an auto shipment for this product. And she didn't know what that meant, and they said, you're under no obligation, and you don't want anything that we send you, you can just send it back, or you don't have to pay for it. Well, cut to the chase, you know, it ended up that they kept sending her this product month after month after month at $60 a bottle, and she didn't want it. She tried to call a number to cancel, and she couldn't cancel, and she tried, you know, sending them letters, and they, you know, wouldn't get them, or she got no response. And finally, she reached someone, and they said, well, we're not going to charge you, you know, for future shipments, but, well, since you've already gotten this past product and you've used it, we can't give you that refund, so we're going to bill you $120, and then we're going to cancel the rest of your order. So the consumer's at $120, not something she's going to fight about. He just kind of soaks it up and goes on. But it's that kind of thing that happens. And so we were involved in a multi-state case involving this Triad Discount Buying Club out of Florida that upsold a lot of products to consumers. And now that's, you know, a national case that receives some attention that all the states participated in, where telemarketers doing very similar things. So, you know, we do see these abuses, and we're hoping this legislation will target that, and at a minimum, at least require these marketers, not only telemarketers, but other, you know, direct marketers, to make consumers aware of what their obligations are in some fashion that we can easily verify. And if it's not written consent from the consumer, at least have it be in some form of verifiable consent, either over the telephone or through a confirmation mailing or something of that sort. And we're certainly happy to work with the representative and Mr. Flint and his clients to come up with language that works for everyone. And I would like to respond just briefly to a question earlier about why you couldn't send an invoice and have a box on there that you didn't check. It says, no, I don't want this, thank you very much, and send it back. Those kinds of things actually look essentially like bills. Sometimes you don't know that it's not an invoice and that you have to pay, and some consumers will get those things, not see that little box, not see the fine print. No, I got an invoice, I got to pay it. Heck, there's a huge scam going on now involving Yellow Pages, and you probably all receive these things.
Oh, yeah.
They come in the mail, they look like invoices, you know, hey, your Yellow Pages, internet ad, you know, listen, your business is going to cost you $69.95, you know, a year, please send your check to this, you know, place. Well, it's really an advertisement, and they're asking you if you want that service, but it looks like an invoice, and a lot of businesses don't really read it. They send a check and on it, and we're concerned that just by sending, you know, putting a box on an invoice that lets the consumer out of this transaction, you know, might not alert consumers sufficiently that that's the way that you need to cancel these things. So I hope that answers that question. And with that, I'll be quiet and be happy to answer questions from the community. Thank you.
Representative Guerra and then Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I've passed around various forms of an amendment I've been working on. It's only the most recent one that I passed around that I'm going to work from. Ed, I appreciate it. And actually, it's really useful to have the examples that you use to sort of bring the issue to life. What I'm thinking about doing, and I just want to run this by you, is to keep all the protections in the current bill as they are, but also on top of those protections to add this, and early in your testimony, it sounded like you agreed with me, and then later in your testimony, it sounded like you didn't agree with me, so I'm going to run this one by you. On top of the existing protections, I would like to have a form where somebody is reminded 30 days before they're going to get charged that this is how you get out of the transaction. And frankly, the form would also need to be one that the consumer could fill out to send back. Because I don't want to make the consumer rely on a telephone number that they can't call while they're at work. And so I was thinking of saying, doing an amendment that says within 30 days of the first billing, the consumer should be provided a form that clearly states how the consumer can discontinue service without payment. And the form shall provide a box or other space allowing the consumer to indicate they wish to discontinue service, and the form must be accompanied by a return envelope. Does that strike you as that strikes me as something that I would like to add, but I guess I would like to hear your opinion.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I think that's a terrific idea, and I didn't mean to suggest in my testimony that that wouldn't work. I think if it's a separate confirmation that is separate from an invoice, that works very well, because then consumers, they're getting a form that doesn't look like an invoice. It doesn't tell them to pay any money. It just says, you've agreed to this, we're going to send you an invoice for this product, and this is how much it's going to cost you, and if you don't want this, or if you don't remember doing this deal, you need to call this number, or you need to check this box and send it back to us. Something that doesn't confuse the consumer with the fact that this may be an invoice they have to pay, I think would be preferable. And, you know, 30 days is good, even 15 days would be good. I know in the amendment proposed by Mr. Flint's client, the Direct Marketing Association, they had an alternative requiring the seller to send the consumer a written confirmation at least 10 days before charging the consumer that included a telephone number that the consumer could use to cancel. And I think it is also a way that you could do it in writing for the reasons you suggest, Representative Guerra, and that would be good as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thanks, Ed. I don't want to put the companies through an undue burden of cost, though, so the two alternatives, I guess, we have are having the separate form that you can fill out, and then either having that as part of an invoice or not part of an invoice. I guess I don't mind it being part of an invoice as long as the sort of thing that lets you opt out clearly states how the consumer can opt out.
Representative Guerra, I think that would be okay. It would just have to be something that's carefully reviewed. So if we started getting complaints, and we look at these invoices with the real small, you know, four-point type disclaimer at the bottom that says, you know, check this box that no one can read if you want to cancel. I mean, as long as it was done clearly and conspicuously, I think that might work.
All right. That sounds fair. Then I think I might go along that route then and try and take into account your suggestion that it be very clear. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg and then Og.
Yes, Mr. Sniffen, something caught my eye and this is a very technical kind of a thing. It's on page 3, lines 24 and 25, where you define seller. And I looked up the definition of seller in the Uniform Commercial Code, which is a little bit different than this, and that is in AS 4502-103, subsection 4. And it says, seller means a person who sells or contracts to sell goods. And then goods is defined in the UCC, and its definition is pretty comprehensive, AS 4502-105. And the term contract is also defined in the UCC. This is in the article on sales in AS 4502-106. And for the folks on the committee and in the audience who aren't attorneys, the Uniform Commercial Code generally governs the laws of the sale, in this case, the article on sales, the sales of goods. And it's in force in every state, and everybody generally is pretty familiar with it because it's a uniform act. The act is very well drafted because everything is defined somewhere in it. And you don't have to look as much to common law, except as they may interpret the exact language of the statute. You don't have to go find a case somewhere in the Alaska statutes, or if it's in the annotations. The definition of seller there includes a person who doesn't just sell the goods, but who contracts to sell. And I thought that was a good aspect here, because you could enter into a contract before you actually made the sale, and you're still covered. But it only covers goods, and this covers goods and services. And it seems to me that that's beneficial also. And what I'm wondering is whether I can see that this thing covers services, which are not covered in the UCC. And Mr. Sniffen, I'm going to ask you a series of questions, if I may, through the chair.
And then just to let you know, we're going to set the bill aside here in the next 5 minutes, so feel free to ask questions.
Be very brief.
And then I just was going to ask, and I just let Representative Meyer know that you and Representative Guerra, if you can work with him between now and the end of the week, we'll bring it back up again just to be sure that any amendments are in order and so on. So please continue.
Okay. Mr. Sniffen, was that the reason?